This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and this is one of the longest running series that we do.
Oh, damn it.
As part, thanks, Nick. You ruined it. You ruined everything.
Listen, listen. When you say longest running, it's like a Pavlovian response at this point.
Listen, it's you, Pavlovian response. I like it. Speaking of Pavlovian responses, you are listening to the longest running weekly
episodic.
Comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. And this is the Long Book Hunters, one of our longest running features that goes all the way back.
No, it's not the Long Book Hunters.
You're right, it's not the Long Book Hunters. What is it? What the hell is we doing tonight? Countdown! For God's sake.
We are off to a rip-roaring start if there ever was one.
You know what? Countdown, Long Book Hunters, who gives a shit? What I'm saying is we're doing the episode that we do once a month where we count down things. It's called Countdown, in fact. And as you know, if you've been paying any attention to this show in recent weeks, we are in the midst of Wonder Woman Month here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys, here at Place to Be Nation Pop. And as part of that, we found it appropriate to take a look at the character of Wonder Woman as we know her best, which is through the 2016 through present day, Greg Rucka written Wonder Woman Rebirth series. Now, both Nick and I are in the same boat as we did not grow up reading Wonder Woman comics. We didn't really start regularly reading them until the Rebirth initiative of last year. However, both of us have Wonder Woman. Well, I don't want to spoil the upcoming prestigious Haffy Awards, but both of us hold the Wonder Woman series in high esteem. I believe it is fair to say.
Yeah, that is of course fair to say. We have, you know, for the better part of a year now, we have lavished it with praise at every opportunity. It has constantly been a feature atop our top three books of the week. So it comes as no surprise that we are huge fans of the series. And so we thought, what better way to celebrate Wonder Woman? What better way to celebrate, you know, that book coming up on its 25th, landmark 25th issue than to take a look back and count down our top five favorite issues of this series thus far. To clarify, we are only counting down the Rebirth issues because, quite frankly, Greg, I don't think you or I have ever read Wonder Woman as an ongoing series before now. So this is all we have, unfortunately.
Right. We're not counting the original run of Greg Rucka Wonder Woman comics because we haven't read them. So, I mean, I think I've read one or two that tied into Infinite Crisis, but I have not had a chance to read that run in its entirety, something that I hope to remedy one day. But what we do have is we have a cavalcade of issues to look through and to pour through, all of which are high quality. I don't think there's been a bad comic book in this bunch from what I've read. Now, here's the caveat for me. Nick is up to date on his read-through. I have only read through issue 17 of this series. I have them all. They are all in my possession. However, I have not gotten around to reading them all. And so my list is a little more limited than Nick's is. I had 17 issues to pour through and choose the five best, in my opinion. Nick has a much more expansive list that he had to pare down. So that's the caveat here. I'm sure Nick is going to have some wonderful issues in his list that will not appear in mine, primarily due to the fact that I have not read them, so it wouldn't be fair for me to rank them. Gotcha. So that's the caveat.
Let me insert another caveat here, folks. During this show, I apologize if I am not at my best. I have to explain. I am dealing currently with a simultaneous inner and outer ear infection in my left ear. And what, the best way I could describe it to you is it feels as if someone took an impact drill to my left ear and then allowed Klondike Bill to go in on the ensuing wound with a pulse of kielbasa. So that's kind of what I'm dealing with right now. And the worst part of it, the worst part of it all is after dealing with the impact drill wound and the Klondike Bill with the pulse of kielbasa, I then have to take Greg Phillips' voice and insert it into the wound. So it is the worst of all situations here. So I apologize if I'm a little bit more ornery than usual.
What is your favorite phallic shape, and why is it a Polish kielbasa sausage?
Well, quite frankly, because you – never mind. We're not going to go there. But speaking of Klondike Bill, Greg, did I ever tell you about the time that I asked Klondike Bill what he would do with a woman who was just extremely clean and well-kept?
No. Please, you got to tell us now.
Well, Klondike Bill told me that if he ever came across a woman who was extremely clean and well-kept, he would tell her to put on a pair of sweatpants and a sweatshirt, go take a 2-mile jog, and then come back and see him when she was done.
Oh, that's disgusting. What has become of this show?
Is that your Conrad Thompson or your Chad Campbell?
I think there's – oh, come on. I think there's a
– What?
I think there's a shirt in this.
Well, you know. Oh, my God. We should get a pro wrestling tee store, even though we do a comic book podcast. I don't think there are any prerequisites for having a pro wrestling tee store.
What if we started one and we actually made money off of it?
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine?
How many longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcasts in all of Place to Be Nation shirts do you think we could sell?
It would have to be like a Kevin Smith-style quadruple XL basketball jersey or hockey jersey in order to fit all the words
Kevin
on it.
Kevin Smith in a basketball jersey, a sleeveless basketball jersey. That is something I kind of want to see, just for the novelty of it.
So we'd have to have that. I mean, we could put the Ho-Ho Loon. That might cause some sort of copyright issue. I'm not sure, but I think there's possibilities here. But
I like it. I'm just saying that, yeah. I like it. Damn it.
Well, quite frankly, I think that we need to hire a financial planner to help us figure out how to do this. I know a guy that runs a realty company and has a couple podcasts under his belt that might be able to do us a solid.
You know, my wife texted me the other day and said, I finally figured out where I've heard Conrad Thompson's voice before. And I was like, wait a minute, you know who Conrad Thompson is? And it was a very strange point of our interest intersecting.
Wow. How does she know Conrad Thompson?
Apparently he did a guest spot. She's heard me listening to some of the shows in passing. And then also apparently he did a guest appearance on a podcast that she listens to that is not primarily wrestling related. So,
there are podcasts that are not primarily related to wrestling or comic books.
I was about to say, we do one that's not related to yeah, there are good ones. There are good ones out there that talk about other things, presumably. You know, the big podcast with Shaq, of course, being primary upon them.
It sure does sound exciting the way that he pitches it on the commercials. Well, hey, y'all, this is Shaq. You're going to tune into the show. We're going to talk about a lot of things. It's going to be good.
And I'm sure that it is. Quite frankly, Shaquille O'Neal has more charisma and entertainment in his little pinky than you've ever had in your whole fucking life, you mark.
Well, that's just false. Patently false. I've had a lot of charisma in my body the last time I hung out with Klondike Bill.
Well, quite frankly, or Toots Mott for that matter. But we are
discipline.
We are getting way off topic. What are we talking about again?
We're talking about Wonder Woman.
Oh yeah. The we haven't done that before.
And powerful Wonder Woman series by Greg Rucka that I am now officially not going to tag him in on Twitter after this opening. So let's get started with our countdown. And I'm going to get us started at number 5. And my number 5 selection for the best issue of the Greg Rucka written Wonder Woman series comes to us very early on, and it is Wonder Woman number 4 by Greg Rucka, Nicola Scott, Romulo Fajardo Jr., and Jody Wynn.
Oh, Romulo, my boy.
Who's your favorite man involved in this story, and, And why is it Steve Trevor? So this is an issue in which one of the things that I really love about what Greg Ruck has done with Wonder Woman is his story works for longtime fans because it's reintroducing elements of Wonder Woman's mythos that they may be familiar with. But for newcomers like Nick or I, it feels like – or like Nikolai Volkoff that might be reading for the first time. It feels like Rucka understands the importance of world building here, because I come at it as someone who – my primary exposure to Themyscira and the DC Universe versions of the Greek god characters comes through the cartoon series Justice League. So having a chance to familiarize myself with this version of Themyscira and how its political system works and how the people who live there, the Amazons, interact with one another is wonderful. And that's pretty much what this issue is all about. It's about world building. It's showing you how Themyscira is set up, how their society is, how the Amazons' power structure is laid out. And simultaneously, while it's showing us this beautiful, amazing society, it also is juxtaposing that with Diana and what makes her different from them. And what makes her, even in this society of amazing women, what makes Diana stand apart from them all and gives her her uniqueness, her willingness to brave the unknown, her willingness to accept those that she doesn't understand. I really feel like this is one of the best examples in the entire Rebirth initiative, actually, of world building. Of, I think Aquaman's had a couple of issues like this as well that have done a good job of this, but of just showing new readers or people who maybe aren't as familiar with the mythos what it is that makes this mythology unique in comics and what makes it stand out and be different even from something like Thor or something over in Marvel. It's just a different way of presenting a comic book character and her supporting cast, and it does it unapologetically. It doesn't hide from it. It doesn't try to make it badass or edgy. It just embraces the mythology that surrounds Diana and that sense of naivete and hope that makes her what she is. So this is my number 5 issue, and honestly, I kind of wanted to put it higher, but I ended up just being able to slot it at number 5. But Wonder Woman number 4 gets my nod.
That's good to hear, sir. One of the things I'm fairly sure will be very different about our list is this is something we've discussed on the show over the last year. Is you generally were higher on the Greg Rucka and Nicola Scott stuff that they did during year one, while I was generally higher on the Greg Rucka and Liam Sharp stuff throughout the run. So your list will have more representation of the Nicola Scott stuff than mine will, for sure. But moving on to my number 5, and I don't want to say too much about this one because it's one of two books on the list that you will have not had an opportunity to read. And it's a very recent issue. It is Wonder Woman number 23. This is bringing to you the final part of the Truth storyline. And all I'll say about this is it might be Liam Sharp's best drawn book of the entire run. It is beautiful and heartbreaking to look at moments throughout. It redefines our understanding of a classic longtime Wonder Woman villain, and it has themes of loss and love, and there are two characters who suffer a tragic, who have to make tragic decisions at the end of this and have to face the world in the wake of those decisions, and it helps you to understand the juxtaposition between these two female characters. And I really don't want to say too much else, Greg, because I don't want to spoil it for you, but for anybody who's read Wonder Woman 23, you know what I'm talking about. So I'm going to keep this one kind of short again because I don't want to spoil too much for Greg, but Wonder Woman 23 takes home my number 5 spot.
Very, very good. Interested in catching up to that for sure. And just to address it, I have plenty of representation from both the Nicola Scott and Liam Sharp issues in my list. It's not one or the other necessarily. I think the initial arc I enjoyed more on year one. I think that some of the later stuff I enjoyed more in the Liam Sharp department. But let me move on to my number 4, which is Wonder Woman number 9. Number 9?
That's my painting.
Wow, we both had it at number 4?
Absolutely. Wonder Woman number 9.
Wow. Writer Greg Rucka, artist Liam Sharp, and of course colorist Laura Martin, who is wonderful on this series throughout, do this one. And I think, Nick, we probably have this on for the same reason, and that is because beneath our harsh, snarky, masculine exteriors is a shipper just waiting to explode. And the shipper in us, I think, is what makes this issue so beloved to us, because this is the Wonder Woman and Steve Trevor romance issue. And there's no getting around it. This is a romance comic. This is the most unabashedly romantic, the most unabashedly love-centered issue, I think, of this entire series to this point. And it just works the same way that we've seen in Rebirth the Lois and Clark relationship or the Oliver and Dinah relationship. That's what
Arthur and Mira,
that's what Rucka and Liam Sharp are able to do with this Steve Trevor and Diana relationship. And it's impressive because one of the things that we've talked about kind of off the air and in some of our shows that haven't come out yet is I have never really gotten the Steve Trevor character until Rebirth.
Yep.
Even in the outstanding Geoff Johns Justice League run, he was just kind of there. He was, you know, Steve Trevor was not really a character that, you know, he was fine. He wasn't bad. He just never really stood out to me, and I didn't really understand why Wonder Woman would want to be with him based on his characterization that he's had. And one of the things that Rucka did in Rebirth, and of course Liam Sharp with his redesign of Steve Trevor, and Laura Martin with her colors, is they gave us a version of Steve Trevor that suddenly clicks, and it's like, oh, I get it. I actually accept the fact that this guy could be with the best woman in the world, which Diana is. That's the way she's presented. That is, she is the not just in terms of her look or her aesthetic, but she's just the best person, the female version of Superman, if you will. And just like you buy that Lois would be with Superman, I now buy that Steve would be with Diana. And they make me invest in this relationship and actively root for it to succeed. And that's impressive to do for a character that I had no attachment to going in. So, yeah, this one makes my list because of that romantic aspect and because of the fact that, again, Greg Rucka just does not care. He does not have any hang-ups about being called a shipper or being called a, you know, or being called out for making, ooh, that's a girly comic or whatever. He doesn't care about any of that crap because that's what it is. It's crap. And he writes it really, really well, this style of comic book. So hats off.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with you, Greg. It is primarily the Steve Trevor and Diana stuff that makes me love this issue. And I think it's one of those – it's really remarkable how I can go in the course of 9 issues – and I say 9 issues, but really – well, yeah, 9 issues because he's in the year one storyline as well. So 9 issues from not caring about a character at all to completely understanding what the appeal of the character is and why he fits so well with Diana. It is a remarkable job by Greg Rucka of kind of bringing people in on the ground level as it pertains to Steve Trevor and building goodwill from the jump. You know, the scene where they have a conversation here on the beach is so beautifully written. It's so perfect in so many ways. One of the aspects I love about it is that it confronts directly the Superman and Wonder Woman relationship from New 52. And it, you know, in hindsight, I went back and read it this week, and it feels like a little bit of meta commentary from Rucka on why the relationship was done in the first place when Diana says something to the effect of, you know, I'm good at loving, but not so good at romance, and being with him was just simple. Almost like it's saying it's easy. That's the fallback, is to do your two most powerful and prominent characters in a relationship, because it cuts out the need to write those human characters that some people find, like you said, boring or less interesting or whatnot. So I love everything about this book. I also love the bits in here from Etta Candy and Barbara Ann Minerva, who is back to her human form in this one. There's a fantastic scene at a shopping mall where they're shopping for clothes for Barbara Ann, and Wonder Woman is, you know, besieged by a throng of people, and Etta has a great line when Barbara asks why she spends the time dealing with them, and she's like, it's not because she has to, but because she knows what it means to them that she does. Just a great, you know, a little pause issue, not a ton of action per se in this one, but it's often those little interlude issues that really help you get to the core of who these characters are. And I think that's why I loved it so damn much.
And I think that certainly you, Nick, and even me as well, we tend to like the issues that a lot of people consider to be boring issues. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I made no secret of the fact that Ultimate Spider-Man is one of my favorite – is my favorite comic book series of all time. And a lot of my favorite issues are the ones where it's Peter and MJ dealing with teenage relationship drama, or issues that are just about Peter going to high school. And the superheroics, to me, were almost like the secondary appeal of that book, and it was the character interactions that I looked forward to every month, you know, first and foremost. And so that has always kind of colored my perception of comics, and it winds up – it's the reason why stuff like Thor God of Thunder number 12 is one of my favorite single issues I've ever read, and it's literally just Thor going around Midgard talking to people. Stuff like that has always hit for me in a big way, and this is just another great example of that.
A great example, and for me – I get captured by this every time I read the book, but I may be the only person that actually rereads Hollis Mason's autobiography every time I read Watchmen, because it's so fascinating.
You have to. I mean, it's essential. You know, Alan Moore, everything he does in Watchmen is intentional. It's there for a reason, and there is no reason whatsoever for anyone to alter that material in any way, shape, form, or fashion. And I, quite frankly, think that anyone who does such is a bastard.
Is a bastard and doesn't deserve to have a comic book podcast.
Absolutely.
Now let's move on from that before we get too heated. We don't want to diverge too much, unless it's to talk about Klondike Bill. Let me get on to my number three issue of Wonder Woman, and that would have to be, appropriately enough, issue number three. And this is obviously very, very early in the run. This is by Greg Rucka, Liam Sharp, Laura Martin. And the reason that this made my list is the characterization of Cheetah and the relationship between Cheetah and Diana. This is another reclamation project. Now, I have to give credit to my partner here, Nick. You have likened Rucka and Sharp's reimagining of Cheetah to Geoff Johns and Ethan Van Sciver's reimagining of Sinestro back in Green Lantern Rebirth all those years ago. And I think that's a great comparison, because Cheetah is another character that, again, I haven't read a lot in the comics, but when I've encountered her in other media or in the comics, again, I've never really gotten her. I didn't understand what made her interesting. I didn't understand why she was a threat to Diana. I didn't understand anything about her, really, that made her stand out or made her unique. Now I do. And it's all, in my opinion — you can talk about the later issues and how wonderful they are, and that's all true — but it all goes back to this issue, because this is the first time we really get to see what her characterization is like in here. We get to see the pain and the torture that she goes through. I think that — and his later work is amazing — for my money, this is Liam Sharp's greatest issue of Wonder Woman. And I say that because it is genuinely heartbreaking. If you can read this story and not feel some twinge of pain inside you, then, you know, you're a tougher man than I, because every time I read this issue, it strikes me the empathy that I feel for Barbara and Minerva as she is lashing out, and she has all this rage, and she has all of this self-rage about being violated, essentially, years earlier, and all the things that have happened to her since, and just this — the idea of a sexual assault victim and the trauma they have to deal with. And I thought this handled it so brilliantly, so maturely. And Diana's handling of the situation, again, is why she is who she is and what she is. There's no other superhero in DC Comics, maybe not even Superman, that would handle this situation like this. The fact that instead of fighting Cheetah when Cheetah's trying to fight her, instead of bringing her in for being too vicious, She genuinely tries to calm her down and tries to have a conversation and tries to find out the source of this pain. And I think it's a great life lesson for all of us that instead of lashing out at people and instead of, you know, always trying to find the wrong, let's try to find what the source is of the wrong and see why people are might behave in a way that they do. And I you know, this is what superhero comics are all about when it gets down to it. And I can't say enough about the writing here, but it's the art that I think puts it over the top. The colors, the facial expressions from Liam Sharp, which I know he was on Sellers Points podcast, and that was one of the things both guys talked about that had him on there, Russell and Kelly, about how great Liam Sharp's facial expressions are in his characters. And it's never more on display than it is right here with Cheetah. So this one is not only one of my favorite issues of this comic, it's one of my favorite Rebirth issues to this point.
Yeah, I have to agree wholeheartedly. I was able to reread, I think I narrowed down my list to like 8 contenders and reread them all leading up to this. And this was the last comic I was forced to cut before I made my top 5. So I echo all your thoughts. And one thing I want to call out real quick, he mentioned this, Liam Sharp did when he made the appearance over on the Sellers Point podcast. This kind of is the first time we see Cheetah fully unveiled and in action in this series. And small thing, but a great thing, his decision to add the tear stains to the fur around her eyes adds so much to that character. It is one of the most brilliant artistic decisions he made on the entire run. And I know that seems, you know, silly to say that about such a small thing, but it's a detail that adds so much emotion to that face and really kind of makes the whole thing work on a much higher level. So, yeah, major props for number 3 coming from me as well. But my number 3 book is another one that I'm not going to mention too much about because it's one that Greg hasn't gotten a chance to read yet. And notably, it is the – I'll go ahead and tell some tales out of skewl right here. It is the only issue on my list not drawn by Liam Sharp. And that is because it is Wonder Woman number 24. This is the finale of the God Watch storyline that just came out last week, as a matter of fact. And to go ahead and tell some more tales out of skewl, this is actually my number 2 book of the week for reading and watching this week. So going ahead and jumping ahead to that as well. This is brilliant because it, for the first time in the entire run, it actively ties together both all of the simultaneous storylines. It brings God Watch and the Truth and the Lies together here in one time frame and kind of really serves as the perfect bow on this story that Greg Rucka has been telling about, you know, 3 women in particular. Because he's really been telling a story about Veronica Kale, Barbara Ann Minerva, and Diana. And we see all of them here in conflict with one another. And we have clear understandings of how the events of this series has changed each person, what their reactions to those events are, and how their relationships to one another are now defined. And it is just more expert handling of these characters from Greg Rucka. The Cheetah has, you know, just the most perfectly heartbreaking reaction to these events that have fallen upon her over the last 23 issues. And it's just, I mean, it's nearly perfect, man. I don't know what else to say about it without delving too much into spoiler details, which I don't really want to do. So big shout out as well to Bequise Evely. I know that a lot of people were disappointed, as was I, when Nicholas Scott stepped away. But I thought Evely has stepped up and really knocked it out of the park on her contributions to the series. You know, of all the Rebirth books with the rotating artists, I would argue that between the 3 artists, I think Wonder Woman may have had the most consistently great art from month to month, from issue to issue. It's been a hell of a job by Greg Rucka and the art team of handling the challenges of the biweekly schedule. So big props, major props to Wonder Woman 24. Can't wait for you to get there so we can discuss it down the road.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. On to my number 2, TU issue of the run to this point. And I'm going to go again back towards close to the beginning, and I'm going to go to the year 1 story arc, and I'm going to go to Wonder Woman number 6 by Greg Rucka, Nicola Scott, and Romulo Fiardo Jr.
My boy. Romulo, my boy. Love Romulo.
And Mr. Barnett, what do you think about Alex Wright?
Ha ha!
Very good. So numbers, I talked earlier about what I feel is the importance of world building. I think it's one of the things that drew me into my favorite comic book series of all time, Geoff Johns' Green Lantern, was the sense of world building and the sense of knowing how these characters interact with one another. And this issue is Diana going into the real world, going into arriving into Man's world, and the army doesn't know what to make of her. She's locked up because they're afraid of her, essentially. And she's kind of at a loss because no one can understand her. One of the reasons this book made my list so high is I loved what the creative team did with the language. The way that they drew Diana's – the lettering, if you will, of Diana was so different from everybody else's. And no one can understand what she's saying. And it takes Barbara and Minerva to actually kind of figure out some of what she's got going on. It's not a perfect translation, but Barbara forms a bond with Diana because Barbara's the only one that can understand any of what she's saying. But also, this is the issue where Diana is visited by the gods in the patron gods in animal form, and has these wonderful gifts bestowed upon her by these animals. Essentially, this is how she gains her amazing abilities and understands them, grows to understand them a little bit more. And I think that it's just a great example of showing that fantastical side of Wonder Woman, that mythological side, that childlike whimsy side of Wonder Woman, that, you know, hey, at the end of the day, talking deer and talking birds and talking cats and all other manner of creature, that's just part of the fantasy aspect. And it's very intriguing. It drew me in the first time I read it, and I continued to love throughout the year one story, which I thought was phenomenal, how they introduced these characters to one another and how it laid the basis for what you're seeing in the future, or the present rather, with what their relationships are today. And that goes all the way back to Etta Candy as the kind of the liaison there, the governmental liaison, Steve Trevor as the army guy who is just infatuated with the most beautiful woman he's ever seen, Barbara Minerva, who's the scientist that's kind of out for information and out for new knowledge, but in the process meets all these cool new people that she becomes friends with. And of course, what game is being played right now by the gods, because they've always got some sort of angle going on. So very interesting stuff. And I got to give love to the entire team behind this, because like I said, all the way down to the lettering has been tremendous throughout the Rebirth series.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I agree with everything you just said. The year one storyline was outstanding for a lot of the reasons you mentioned. Very tough not to include any of it on my list, but it was a move I had to make. But moving on to my number two book of the week, number two book on my countdown, and I have a sneaking suspicion. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see if this one winds up at your number one spot or not. But my number two book of this run, I'm going with Wonder Woman number 17 from Greg Rucka and Liam Sharp. This is an installment of the Truth storyline, and it features what is, for my money anyway, the most heartbreaking moment of this entire run, because for 16 issues, you know, this is the 17th issue of the run, Rucka has done a masterful job of reintroducing you to the character of the Cheetah, and the character of Barbara Ann Minerva, helping you to understand the woman behind the Cheetah persona, and helping you to understand what motivates her and why she is damaged the way she is, and helping you to understand and empathize with the true tragedy of that character. And he has taken her, he's shown you all of that tragedy and all of that loss, and brought her so far forward in terms of helping her to heal, and only to make it even more tragic by having her take a massive step backwards and being forced to become the cheetah once again, not out of selfish motivations, but in an effort to help her friends, people she genuinely cares about. And this, to me, just adds a whole new dynamic to the Wonder Woman and Cheetah conflict. It is beautiful. It is amazingly drawn by Liam Sharp, that whole entire sequence. And you called it out, I believe, on last week's show, Greg, after you got a chance to read this. That moment where Wonder Woman and Steve and Etta and Ferdinand are all being fired upon by Team Poison, and all of a sudden the firing stops, and you see Steve and Diana and Ferdinand get up to survey the scene, but you see Etta Candy just almost slump over even more because she knows why the firing has stopped. It is
right.
A beautiful, subtle moment. It really almost epitomizes so many of the things I love about the way Greg Rucka writes this book. I can't say enough good things about Wonder Woman 17. This is, for my money anyway, the biggest Cheetah issue of the entire run. So, love the hell out of issue 17.
That's my painting! Because that is my number one issue of the Greg Rucka Wonder Woman run. Wonder Woman number 17. Rucka, Liam Sharp. Incredible what they did in this issue. I agree with you, Nick. You said it perfect, Bubba, and I said a lot of it last week, so I'm not gonna tread over too much ground here, except to say that this is such an example of that hand in glove partnership that makes comics different from any other medium, in that this would not work as well as prose, and this would not work as well as a standalone sequence of art. It works together. The words, the images, the trust that Rucka has in Liam Sharp to tell his story, it's just remarkable. It's unbelievably moving. The pain with the choice that Barbara has to make, and by the end of the issue, it becomes apparent what choice she's going to have to make. And then, again, that one panel of Etta Candy's reaction makes the entire thing. It puts it at the top of my list because it caused an emotional response in me, and whenever comics can do that, I'm gonna have a special place in my heart for them. And it's, like I said with the last couple issues, it's one of the best issues in the entire Rebirth Initiative, one of the best comics I've read in a while. Incredible work. And another step in the process of crafting the Cheetah into something more than she was.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. But moving on to my number one book, or number one issue of the Wonder Woman Rebirth run, I am going back to the early days, and I am going with Wonder Woman number 7. This issue features the big confrontation between Diana and the plant god Urzkartaga. It also features Urzkartaga and the Cheetah coming face-to-face with one another for the first time in a while. Diana and Steve coming face-to-face with one another for the first time in a while. It's got so many great moments, from Wonder Woman calming a group of captive women to Wonder Woman swooping in and saving Steve, and Steve's seemingly nonchalant reaction to it because you get the impression that he is used to being saved by Diana. You get Diana just throwing the ever-loving smackdown on Urzkartaga. It's the equivalent of building him up and building him up and building him up, and then having Diana play the Brock Lesnar to his John Cena, essentially, where she just tears through him over the course of the issue. And it is beautiful to behold, as Liam Sharp shows he can do a hell of a lot more than just the facial expressions and the quiet character moments, as he gets great action scenes out of this one. But also, this ultimately has the reveal of Diana telling Barbara that Urzkartaga didn't turn her into the Cheetah because she was impure when she got there. He turned her into the Cheetah because he does that to all of his past brides. And it's that moment where you realize the storyline, the lies, means so much in terms of every character is discovering they have been lied to over the course of the book. And it's also a great moment of hope, as you see Barbara Ann reverting to her human form, and it kind of feels like after a run where we've, you know, a run of issues here in the lives where it's been pretty bleak and dark, it shows you these moments of hope that Diana can provide to all of those people around her. And to me, it still holds up as the best issue of the entire run. I think it's Rucka writing at his best, and I think it's Liam Sharp drawing all of the supporting characters and action scenes at his best.
Quite frankly.
Indeed.
Very good. I agree. Excellent issue. Another issue that got consideration for my list. This has been such a consistent series, and I hope that came across as we gave you our lists, ladies and gentlemen, that this series is just loaded with consistency. And I think that owes to the fact that it's had a relatively consistent artistic presence with its three primary pencilers. And I think it's also because Greg Rucka has remained the lead writer all the way through this point. And his vision has helped, along with the artist's visions, has helped cultivate what's been, in our opinion, I think, the best of all the Rebirth series in terms of consistency. So just to wrap things up, let's give the folks our lists one more time. At number 5, I had issue number 4. At number 4, I had issue number 9. At number 3, I had issue number 3, appropriately enough. At number 2, I had issue number 6. And at number 1, I had issue number 17.
Absolutely. For me, at number 5, I had issue 23. Number 4, I had issue 9. Number 3, I had issue 24. At number 2, I had issue 17. And at number 1, I had issue 7.
Excellent. And how did we do, folks? Did we nail it? Did we leave some out that you wanted on your list? Give us your list. We want to see those lists. Go to Facebook.com and search for Place to Be Nation Comics. Join the group and leave us your lists. We would love to share them on the air if you leave those with us. Tweet us. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. Send us an email. GregP@placetobenation.com. NickD@placetobenation.com. I would love to see your lists. If you give us a list, we'll try to remember to read it on the air next week, perhaps, and let people know what some of the listeners out there think about the Wonder Woman series by Rucka. What have been the highs for them? And as always, we welcome your feedback on the entire show. And
ooh.
Ho-ho-loon. For the ho-ho-loon ticker alert. Look at this. It's coming across right now. Let's see a little bit of what we've got coming across the ticker here. Let's see. Citric acid. Sodium citrate. May contain traces of milk. Guaranteed to fully satisfy with quality of every product. Ho-ho-loon. Still employed by World Wrestling Entertainment.
And consequently still in the WrestleMania 33 program.
Wow. You heard it here first, folks. You cannot get news updates like this on CNN, on Fox News, on MSNBC. You can't get it from the mainstream media. You can only get this right here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Right, Nick?
That's absolutely right. You know, that ticker, that technology that we have on that ticker, Greg, some might say that it's got a certain slickness to it that, quite frankly, wouldn't be for me to say.
Wouldn't be for you to say. It is as slick as, well, certain bodily functions slick. on certain types of metal that may be used in certain orifices of the human body.
Well,
nevertheless, we hope you'll stick with us through the break, folks. When we come back, we've got what is sure to be a rousing edition of Reading and Watching. We've got a look at your news and notes throughout the comic book world, and who knows what the hell else we got coming your way. Just stick with us, folks. You won't regret it.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuitas podcast, The Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
But I've heard that you're bringing Klondike Bill back as the national name. Do you have any Klondike Bill stories you haven't told yet?
I think I've told every story that I know.
Did you tell the story about when doing the money grab on the baseball?
I haven't told that one.
Will you tell it to us?
Yes, I'll tell it to you. This was like 1983, and I was working with the baseball team, and they had a money grab where they brought six people out on the field to grab play money, and they could cash in for real money. Klondike, instead of littering the field with money, just dumped it, boom, right on top of the mound. Four or five people went in, had these big Bandlon shirts, and they got all this money. One person won like $7,500 that night. The baseball team had to shut down concession stands, had to lay off people because of all that money. And Bill said, "Hey, I wasn't told what to do. I wasn't told to dump it on the top of the mound. I just do what I thought was natural." I said, "Well, great job, Bill. Well, about 10 people are unemployed right now because of you."
I love that story. Yeah. It never gets old.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Hard Traveling Fanboys Countdown, and we're ready to wrap this thing up down the closing stretch here by getting into our two recurring segments, the first of which is a little thing that we do where we like to talk about what we've been viewing and what we've been experiencing in terms of the written word, a segment we call
What You've Been Written and Watching.
And yes, that was an elaborate setup, folks, but I couldn't think of any other way to pitch it. So there you have it. Reading and watching. Now, I haven't been reading anything. I was out of town. I have not had time. No reading from me. So, Nick, it's all you this week, buddy, as it often is.
Outstanding. And since it's just me again, I'll do them in whatever order I damn well please. And so I'll start from the bottom once again, much like Klondike Bill, from what I understand, likes to start from the bottom.
He likes to start from the bottom of a glass table, actually.
But that is neither here nor there. And at my bottom book of the week, I've got Batgirl and the Birds of Prey number 11. This is part one of the Source Code storyline. This thing, you know, it's again, I don't really have any books on my pull list that are not of a fairly high quality at this point. So I still enjoyed this issue. It's just like I had to pick a bottom book. Enjoyed it, but, you know, when all things are considered equal, I will say that the art from time to time can hold this book back. And that was the main thing I didn't like about it, was the art. I found the storyline to be pretty intriguing. They're starting to pay off some of the larger mysteries that have been set up since the title's inception. And it's working out well. If only we could get a new artist, I feel like this book could really become one of the best books in Rebirth. But, you know, at this point, the art is something you have to get through to enjoy the story, which is still pretty good and well-written, and the characters have pretty sharp characterizations as far as I'm concerned.
And pretty sharp teeth.
A pair of razor sharp
bicuspids.
So, yeah, Batgirl and the Birds of Prey number 11, that's my bottom book of the week. Moving on to my number 3 book of the week, and this is one that got a lot of buzz during last week's release period. And that is, of course, DC's Dark Days The Forge number 1. This is one of two different issues, the other being the casting coming up in July, that serve as preludes to Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo's upcoming Metal event this fall. You had Snyder and James Tynion IV here on the writing duties, and then you had what a plethora of all-star artists collaborating on this one, from Jim Lee to Andy Kubert to John Romita Jr. to Klaus Janson. You just had a lot of people doing some outstanding work. And
that is a Justice League roster of artists.
Absolutely. It is, and while it does lend itself to giving the book a little bit of an inconsistent feel in terms of the art, the fortunate thing is it kind of jumps around throughout the DC universe, and so it's a little bit easier to accept the art shifts when they happen. All that being said, I very, very much enjoyed this one. I do think it's not overly accessible to new readers. It seems like that would be the case, you know, for those who aren't as well versed in DC as you or I. But that being said, some of the aspects they reintroduce here are just they are pure fanboy service, for lack of a better term. Whether it be the tease of Plastic Man possibly returning to the DCU, and a certain callback to a certain 2005 crossover event written by Geoff Johns that I think you will mark out big time for when you finally getting around to reading it. So, yeah,
oh.
I love this one. And I will say, Scott Snyder writing Hal Jordan is every bit as great as you would hope that it would be. Because there are three characters that are kind of the main narrators of the story, and those being Batman, Hawkman, and Hal Jordan. And Scott Snyder writes a hell of a Hal Jordan.
It's got to happen someday, Nick. It's got to. He's got to be on a Green Lantern ongoing.
Maybe one day. So then moving on to my number 2 book of the week, I mentioned it during the first half of our show. My number 2 book of the week is Wonder Woman number 24, so not a whole lot else to say about that one. And that brings me to my number 1 book of the week, and this series just continues to blow me away with how well written it is and how, you know, just how inventive it is. And folks, I know there's a lot of people upset about the very concept of this event, but Secret Empire continues to knock it out of the park. I absolutely loved this issue. It features the Resistance, led by Tony Stark, and the Hydra forces, led by Captain America, being forced into an awkward situation where they are forced to actually have a conversation with one another in this bizarre mansion setup that Ultron has created. Ultron, apparently, in this version of the Marvel Universe, is laboring under the delusion that he and Hank Pym have actually merged consciousnesses. So he sees himself as not just somebody who is meant to correct the world, but is also somebody who is meant to help bring the Avengers back together. And so he almost forces these disparate, these different heroes from across the Marvel Universe to come together and, you know, face their differences head on. And it's almost like this prolonged bit of psychological torture, Greg. It reminds me a whole lot, actually, of that episode of Jessica Jones where the Purple Man is forcing her to live in her childhood home and confront all these demons and stuff.
Yeah.
It's really, really well done. And I just continue to be blown away by Secret Empire, man. Nick Spencer's absolutely killing it for me, to the point where I would say at this point, we got six more issues to go, so we got to see how he sticks the landing. But through four issues, I think it's right up there with the best of the best Marvel events of the last 15 to 20 years.
Wow, that is very high praise, sir. I meant to ask you, by the way, about this Dark Metal, the Forge, whatever the hell the name of it is. Does this have anything to do with a mutant character who has the ability to build things and has a mustache?
No.
Ah, damn it. Not interested. Only books about Forge can be called the Forge.
In any event, I've got a few quick hits that I'll run through real quick. Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, number 22, starts the Fracture storyline. Features the return of a classic Green Lantern villain that some consider to be,
well, unnatural,
unrelenting, and it's a good.
Nick, now I need to read it. I need to skip all the other issues and read it.
I would highly encourage you not to skip the other issues. You got to get here, and for once, Volfunga the Unrelenting seems to have a pretty good plan in place that genuinely has befuddled the Green Lantern Corps, and they don't really know what to do with it.
Wow.
So a nice usage of Volfunga here. The Amazing Spider-Man, Renew Your Vows, number 8. This is an MJ-focused issue introducing a new version of the Venom symbiote that kind of works and kind of telling the MJ version of what happens when she is, you know, her mind is altered by the symbiote, and I really enjoy it in that context. Star Wars 32, this continues the Screaming Citadel storyline. BT and Triple Zero just continue to steal the book every damn time they're in it. Detective Comics, 958. Greg, you know, you and I are both very excited by the shipping that's going over in Batman, going on over in the main Batman title. And I'm not saying that I don't want what's going on over there to keep happening, because I certainly do. But if there is one female character that could make me say, oh, man, there's some potential there, too. It's the character that pops up at the end of this one and seems to be joining the book for this storyline. I don't want to say too much else, but, I think you'll enjoy it when you get there. The Defenders, number 1. Loved this one in terms of the writing from Brian Michael Bendis. He always writes Daredevil very well, and he's the best Luke Cage and Jessica Jones writer that has ever walked God's green earth, in my opinion. His Iron Fist stuff is pretty good, too. The thing that kind of holds us back is it's a tremendously underwhelming effort from David Marquez on art. And I usually like Marquez a lot, but I question if perhaps his style may not be the best fit for a street-level book. Still, all that being said, I very much enjoyed this book. And finally, Action Comics 981 continues the revenge storyline by unleashing Zod and having a pretty cool 3-on-1 handicap match of Eradicator, Zod, and Cyborg Superman against Clark. And Clark kind of gets the beatdown put on him, which there's still a part of my heart that enjoys seeing that, being a reformed Superman hater.
Oh, kneel before Zod, huh? I'll kneel before Zod. For God's sake, you're beating it into the ground. We get it.
Oh, Vince McMahon has to play Zod in a movie one day. I'm convinced it needs to happen.
Kneel before Zod, you son of a bitch. Quite frankly, only if we get the two sides of Zod, though. We need the angry Zod, and we also need the, now, quite frankly, let's just talk this out for a minute version of Zod.
Indeed. So, yeah, those are my quick hits.
Very good. Excellent to hear about the goings-on in the comic world. Looking forward to, well, need to watch a bloody thing, I don't think. Is that correct, Nick?
No, we haven't been. I haven't been anyway.
Hell no. Hell no, I haven't. I watched the Magnificent Seven remake the other day with my parents. I've seen it before. It was still very good. But it's not related to comics, so that's neither here nor there. So let's move on to our weekly look at the news and notes from throughout the comic book world. A little segment we like to call...
Welcome to the Rundown. Where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the Rundown. Where we talk about movies too.
Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Well, to start things off, we have a couple of utterly bizarre stories. We wanted to get these out of the way first because I don't know that either of us knows what to make of either aspect of this story. And this story involves the upcoming Sony Spider-Man universe that doesn't have Spider-Man in it. Or does it? You see, based on comments from Marvel Cinematic Universe head Kevin Feige, we were led to believe that the Sony Spider-Man universe, for lack of a better term, that will have the Venom film, the previously announced Silver Sable and Black Cat film, would stand on its own. It would be a part. There would be no Spider-Man involvement. These would be stories that about characters that do not share a world with Peter Parker. Well...
Which is stupid, by the way.
That seemed to be the case until this past week when Sony Pictures chair Amy Pascal said that Venom and Silver...
Sony Pictures chairperson Amy Pascal, by the way.
Ah, my mistake. That Venom and Silver and Black, Sony's two planned Spider-Man spinoffs, are connected to the Marvel Cinematic Universe to the degree that Tom Holland, who is playing Spider-Man in the MCU, could appear in either or both of the films. I'm going to read the quote, and it goes as follows. Open quote. Well, those movies will all take place in the film world, or in the world that we are now creating for Peter Parker. They'll be adjuncts to it. It may be different locations, but it will still all be in the same world, and they will all be connected to each other as well. There's a chance, there's always a chance, and that's referring to Tom Holland. I think one of the things that Kevin has done with Marvel that was so brilliant is by bringing the fans along and making each movie seem like a chapter in a book that you have to read that chapter in order to go forward. And I think the investment that the fans get to feel in being a part of a larger story and understanding what's happening, I think is something that I know Sony would want to emulate. Now, what's interesting is, in the video of these comments, Kevin Feige looks like he's completely taken off guard. So, let's go ahead and just bring in the second part of this story, Nick, and we'll address it all as one entity.
Because right.
The second part of this story is another report came out that, according to The Hollywood Reporter, Sony's got two more Spider-Man spinoffs planned, and let's just say they're a little weird. We've got Kraven the Hunter and Mysterio as planned standalone film projects. Now, I'm not referring to professional wrestler Rey Mysterio, who's had an interesting life that could very well make for a good movie. I'm referring to the fishbowl-wearing, green-clad Spider-Man villain known as Mysterio. So, let's first address the weird MCU and Sony thing. I don't know what to make of this because I'm not entirely convinced that's a thing. I don't know how Sony could be expected to tie its film universe into the MCU without being brought into the greater MCU planning. But I don't know how you do these characters without Spider-Man. So Nick, right. What are your thoughts?
And you got to remember that, based on my understanding of the situation anyway, Sony still technically retains the control and rights to the Spider-Man character. So they are allowing the MCU to use Spider-Man, but that does not prevent them in any way from using him in their own films. I think, you know, the thought process had always been you didn't want to do that, but the more I think about it from Sony's perspective, why wouldn't you want to? Because this isn't going to cause any kind of harm to Sony. The only thing it can hurt is the MCU in terms of screwing with continuity and putting some gum in the works. The way I like to envision it potentially working, Greg, it's almost like a Venn diagram with two separate circles, and the one point of intersection between those circles is Spider-Man. I think Sony is going to create whatever the hell it is they want to create over here, and I think the scale of it and the scope of it in terms of the plot of these movies will be reasonably small enough in terms of the stakes. I don't think the planet Earth is going to be under assault or anything. I think it's going to be reasonably small enough that you can conceivably just not acknowledge it in the larger MCU and not have it be that big of a contradiction. And have Spider-Man appear in those films while also having Spider-Man play his larger role in the MCU. So I think that's how Sony might work it. I do think that, like you said, there was probably a little bit of shock on Feige's part. But honestly, I think the benefits for Marvel far outweigh the risks in terms of being able to use Spider-Man in the MCU and have that character to play with in the large ensemble films. I think it's worth taking the risk on letting Sony do whatever the hell it is Sony wants to do over off on the side, because if Sony's shown anything, they'll release one or two of these, they'll bomb, and then they'll lose all faith in it and not know what the hell to do anymore. So I don't think – I think Feige just needs to give Sony enough rope to hang itself in this instance.
Yeah, I'm still of the I'll believe it when I see it mode. I'm not convinced that this is actually going to be a thing.
I don't know, but okay. I'm trying to think, like, I understand your skepticism, but at the same time, I don't know how you, okay, Venom you can maybe do without Spider-Man. I don't think you should, but you can. And I suppose you can do Silver and Black, which is, never mind, I'm not even going to get into that.
Not a good idea, I agree.
But I don't see a way to do a Kraven or a Mysterio movie that doesn't involve Spider-Man in some capacity.
Here's the thing. But what we're being led to believe is that these are not Spider-Man movies starring Kraven with Kraven and Mysterio as villains. These are standalone. In other words, Kraven is the protagonist and Mysterio is the protagonist. Whether they're portrayed as anti-heroes or whatever, they're
Kraven,
going to be
the Kraven idea could conceivably work. I could see that working where you
sure.
have him presented as a protagonist with a massive ego who grows increasingly.
Played by The Rock.
Oh my God, that would be amazing. Who grows increasingly, you know, dickish and standoffish over the course of the journey of the film and kind of sets him down, you know, a path that would eventually lead him into conflict with Spider-Man. I don't know how, why, or what the benefit of doing a Mysterio film, on the other hand, is.
No idea. I don't understand it. I don't understand many of these projects, to be honest. I don't – maybe you can do something with Silver and Black, maybe you can turn it into something, but
tell me, because you know my primary experience to Spider-Man or exposure to Spider-Man, as I've said many times, is through Ultimate Spider-Man.
Sure.
Was Silver Sable and Black Cat ever a thing? Like, was that ever a pairing in the comics?
Not that I'm aware of.
It's literally just them going, hey, it's two female characters with colors in their name. Let's throw them together.
As far as I know, like, they were around at the same time in the same era of Spider-Man comics
but
when
not,
I was very
like,
young.
Tied as a duo is what I'm saying.
I don't remember them being tied as a duo. If they have,
it's not like Gotham City Sirens, which actually has like a, you know, a comics tie of some sort.
Right. I mean, and again, I don't want to – I am not by any means the source of great knowledge on the Spider-Man mythos. I haven't read the books. My main familiarity with Spider-Man is from early to mid-90s, and I absolutely don't remember that ever being a thing. And so it's just very bizarre to me. All of these decisions are – I mean, I would think you could do a damn Flash Thompson movie before you could do a Mysterio movie, for God's sake.
If you were going to do before a Mysterio movie, the one that I would do would be Scorpion, because it had such an easy story to tell there, a guy who is taken advantage of by J. Jonah Jameson, and then you can kind of tell the story of Scorpion seeking revenge and, JJ throwing various hired goons in his way and eventually getting his revenge on JJ and then, you know, setting off on this path of, you know.
Well, that's a good example. Or even someone like Michael Morbius, the living vampire, or
That's where you get into the aspect of it. Is Morbius considered a Spider-Man character I don't know how these things are broken down. It doesn't make a ton of sense to me.
Yeah, we don't really have a master list for this. You know, like the same thing with the Fox characters. We don't really have a master list. That's available internally, I'm sure. But I don't know that it's been released publicly. But back to the Spider-Man point, the other issue with this is I don't know how having Spider-Man even helps them with these. Because without – it's not like they're going to introduce Venom in Spider-Man Homecoming. And before we get Spider-Man 2 – we're going to get the Venom movie. So it's not like there's going to be a way to introduce Venom the way that it's done in the comics and the way it's been done in the past.
I think the benefit of it for them is you hope to get the rub, so to speak. By having this level of interconnectivity, it kind of sends the message to casual moviegoers that, oh, look, we're kind of like the MCU. We have, you know, all our ducks in a row and all our plans are laid out. And it's all part of one big story. I think the idea is just to get a little of that MCU shine on them, so to speak.
Wonder who signed the rights to these characters. Wonder who got that Spider-Man fella signed up. Must have been a pretty decent studio. Must have been pretty fair.
Yep. I think that's precisely the idea, is to remind people of who actually controls the future of Spider-Man.
What I'm getting out of this, Nick, is that Bill Watts needs to book the Spider-Man universe.
Oh, he would – Bill Watts, you know, no more web-swinging off the
top. No more web-swinging. You have to stay on the ground at all times. It has to be like a chute. You are in a damn chute. Why would you leave your feet if you're in a chute, quite frankly?
Quite frankly. But, yeah, so I agree it's ultra-weird, but I'm kind of trying to take the optimistic viewpoint on it. And I guess ultimately, whatever kind of weird bullshit Sony wants to pull on the side, I'm going to view it as ultimately worth it to get our Spider-Man in the MCU that we've
gotten
this far.
And the one thing that we haven't talked about yet is the good aspect of all of this, because we've talked about Venom and how weird a project it seems it's going to be, but we know Tom Hardy's going to be playing Venom, and now we know who the villain's going to be in the movie, and it will be Carnage. It will not be some weird, random character they pull out of their ass. It's going to be Carnage, and I think that's the way to go.
I'm of two minds about that. Honestly, on the one hand, I agree that Carnage is pretty much the only legitimate Venom villain, so you're kind of hamstrung there, but you think it might be too much to introduce not one but two different symbiotes and the whole idea of them being one being an offshoot of the other all in one film?
No, I think it can actually be done, because you set it up as establishing the dichotomy. You almost set it up as... At least I don't know if they're going to go with the alien route with the symbiote or if they're going to go with the man-made route. I don't know. But I think that you can do it if you establish early in the movie the symbiote splitting and going in two different directions and the difference between what it does with Cletus Kasady and his personality and what it does with Eddie Brock and his personality, so that even if you have a rough around the edges Eddie Brock that you're preparing to potentially be a villain in the future – he's still not going to be as bad as Cletus Kasady, and I think that might be a good way to establish why, even though you may think of Venom as being a dick, you should root for him against this even bigger dick, you know?
I can see that. That makes a lot of sense. I will say that I, for one, hope they do go the space route. Embrace what makes some of these concepts different. Embrace the weirdness of it, you know. Do what Fox is doing with their Dark Phoenix movie, and embrace the cosmic element. Like, try to find that thing that sets yourself apart from all the other superhero movies, and don't go the predictable like scientific experimentation route. Go with the space origin. And I say that as someone who's the biggest advocate of the Ultimate Universe on the face of the planet, but here I say, go cosmic, damn it.
Advocate. Are you competing with Paul Heyman?
No, sir.
Well, that's good. Although physically, we both are starting to resemble Paul Heyman, so.
Paul Heyman's got a little more hair going on than I do, so.
And me. But nevertheless, let's move on to the segment of the show that everyone loves so good. the DCEU corner, because we got some big potential news that's not really news, but just more. What would you say, Nick? What would you, if you had two words to describe something that wasn't news but was being talked about?
Well,
would those words be?
Greg, I think what you're driving at is just a little bit of rumor and innuendo.
That's right, rumor and innuendo. Because as many people have heard this week, the Han Solo movie lost its two directors and gained a new director. And those two directors that were kicked off were Phil Lord and Christopher Miller. And those directors have been replaced by Ron Howard, but that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about the rumor from the Hollywood Reporter and the innuendo that Lord and Miller could be landing at The Flash, which is a movie that we have documented repeatedly here on the show, has just been in what can only be described as developmental hell. Nothing has gone right for this picture to this point. And in April 2015, these two guys, Lord and Miller, were actually hired to write the Flash film. And they were offered the director's gig as well, but they declined. Now, since then, of course, the movie has gained and lost two other directors, Seth Graham Smith and Rick Famuyiwa. And new reports have indicated that Robert Zemeckis and Matthew Vaughn were being considered. But now it looks like Lord and Miller could be returning. No, obviously there's no confirmation that this is going to happen. There's just talk that it is a possibility. Do you see this happening, Nick?
Oh, man. Such a tough question. I don't know. I really don't know because, you know.
Are you going to give me fucking anything on this show, or why are we even here?
Listen up, you slap dick. Let me answer the fucking question if you'll just give me a minute. Since Rick Famuyiwa's departure, the reports have been that Flash was undergoing a page one rewrite. They were almost starting the development of the movie over from scratch, with the only really pre-existing thing in place that were going to be the bit of casting that had been pre-announced, those being Billy Crudup as Henry Allen, Kersey Clemons as Iris West, and, of course, Ezra Miller as Barry Allen. Other than that, the entire story and concept of the film, based on my understanding, was going back to square one. So my question becomes, if Warner was so shaky on whatever that premise was that they were going to go back to square one, would they now be willing to revert back to that prior premise that Lord and Miller came up with a couple of years ago? Because if I'm Lord and Miller and they're actually, let's assume for a moment they're going to come on and do this, we would assume that they're coming on to do the version of the movie that they laid out 2 years ago, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm them and I want to do that, is Warner Brothers going to be okay with throwing out this, you know, rewritten version they've done and reverting back to a prior version? This, you know, this is shaping up to be, if, you know, if this movie ever gets made, it is going to become one of the most fascinating development journey stories in the history of Hollywood, because it has just been so troubled and so, you know, so filled with so many stops and starts and various versions floating around and, you know, reverting possibly back to the original version. I can't wait for the tell-all podcast or book or what have you to be told about the development of this one day, because it has been, from an outsider's perspective, truly fascinating to follow. So to answer your question, ultimately, I think they probably will wind up doing it, just because I think they're going to want to, you know, they're going to need a PR win in the wake of their departure from the Star Wars Han Solo film. And I think, you know, DC is kind of in the need of a PR win as it pertains to the Flash film. And what better way to get that than by, you know, bringing the guys back into the fold who kind of helped get the project off the ground in the first place.
And, you know, if their whole deal is they want to make a zany comedy, maybe the Flash is a character you could try that with. You know, I don't know. I mean, there's certainly – I have my vision of what the Flash should be, and it comes on every week on the CW. But if you're going to do something different, maybe this is your chance to do a comedy in the DCEU. So I would be open to the concept. I'll put it that way. At this point, I'm going to have to plead the fifth on this one because I have no idea where the Flash movie is heading. I hope they take their time with it and do it right. That's my whole deal with it. They don't need to try to meet some artificial release date. Just take your time. Make sure you get it right if you do it.
Well, there's no chance it's coming out on its release date. I don't think they've even officially moved it off that release date yet. You know, in theory, it's still coming out in 9 months, which would be certainly a unique situation.
It would be a major twist in the development, Nick.
What a twist.
And speaking of major twists, Damon Lindelof.
Oh, God.
Damon Lindelof, a well-known writer coming off the heels of his successful show, The Leftovers.
Fuck the Damon Lindelof.
Coming off the heels of his successful series, The Leftovers, on HBO, which I have not seen, but heard good things about.
The Leftovers, is that a collection of all the leftover plot lines from all the other projects he's worked on over the years that he never resolved?
Oh! Is funny, because it's true.
Oh, no, I don't want to hear it, Greg. You're the biggest offender in the world of Prometheus.
Oh, I love Prometheus. No, you're not going to get me to trash Prometheus. I adore Prometheus. I think it's great. I think Prometheus, I have a lot of strong opinions about Prometheus. I like Prometheus. But here's what I don't like. Lost.
Have you ever actually watched Lost?
No, but I followed its development enough to know that I don't have any desire to ever invest time in it. Because everyone who did, you were all suckers. I had to hear many times in college how they've got a plan. They've got a plan. It's the best show on television. They've got a plan. They didn't have a plan, though, as it turns out, Nick. They didn't have a plan.
Quite frankly, I would suggest that not all of us who got invested in Lost got invested of it in it because of the creativity of the show. I would suggest that some of us were required at the time, based on ulterior motives, to get into the show.
At any point, did you have to miss any Monday night wrestling broadcasts?
Not to the best of my knowledge, because I believe the show aired on Tuesdays.
Then I don't want to hear any complaints. So anyway, the reason we bring up Damon Lindelof, what does he have to do with anything, you might ask? Well, I'll tell you. Damon Lindelof is reportedly developing a new series for HBO based on the greatest comic book of all time, Watchmen. Now, we mentioned earlier in the broadcast that if you try to adapt Watchmen and
you're a bastard son of a bitch.
You're a stupid, lousy bastard, douchebag, jerk, loser, and you don't deserve to have a podcast.
You don't deserve to live.
You probably don't deserve to live. You probably deserve to get a massive ear infection, in fact.
And have that ear infection penetrated by Klondike Bill with a pulse of kielbasa.
Yeah. I'm still trying to figure out what a pulski is, but nevertheless.
A polska kielbasa, Greg. It is the technical term for a Polish sausage.
Polish
You'd know sausage. That if you had any culture, you fuck.
Well, quite frankly, I don't – unlike you, I don't stuff my heart with fatty sausages every weekend.
You just stuff your anus with fatty sausages every
weekend. That's right. And you know why? Because it tastes great and it's less filling. Nevertheless.
Where have we gone?
Nevertheless. HBO is developing this series with Damon Lindelof in very early talks to helm it. And no, sir, I don't like it.
I don't know what to make of it, honestly. I don't even know how to articulate this, Greg. What is the point, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. He had a quote that's out there, and it said something to the effect of, he's a big fan of the 2009 Zack Snyder film, and it's the most married to the original version of Watchmen that you could possibly make.
Yep, I'm reading it right now.
And
I want to keep it sort of insular. It's okay. And here's the quote that really got me, Nick, that really, I think, encapsulates why Damon Lindelof rubs a lot of people the wrong way. It's okay with me if people don't understand it because they don't deserve to understand it.
Yeah, I don't even know. But what does that even mean?
What does it mean? Like, it doesn't mean a gosh darn thing.
Like, so you want to make a version of Watchmen that is faithful to the novels, but you acknowledge that that version has already been made.
Yeah.
You can't make a version even more faithful to the novel than has already been made, and yet you acknowledge that you want to make a version that people will not understand.
Which, by the way, what is so brilliant about Watchmen, and one of the many things, is that it works on so many different levels. There is a reading of Watchmen where you can read it as a straight-up literal story, and it works. As a plot, it works. And then there are other layers underneath that. But it's not – by no means is Watchmen incomprehensible, Nick. I have never given the book to anyone or never suggested the book to anyone who has read it and then said, I didn't understand what the hell was going on. Not one person ever I can remember saying that about Watchmen after reading it. So it's a very weird quote. I'm very hesitant about this. I am not against the idea of doing something Watchmen-related. I would love a Minutemen series if that's the direction they want to go in. I think that would be super interesting.
And that's the thing. I wonder about this, if it is intended to be more than just a miniseries. Because if you were calling this a miniseries, like a 10-part or 12-part miniseries that you do the book and you're done, that would be one thing. But apparently, I mean, nobody has come out and said this, but if the idea is to do it as a multi-season television show, the only thing I can imagine is that you would have to be doing some sort of Minutemen or Before Watchmen adaptation. Mm. Because there's just, I mean, the original is great, but I think you would agree that the original is a one-season presentation if you do it on television.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. One season would be plenty. And,
you do an episode for every issue, right? You do an hour adaptation of each issue.
Yeah, I think you could probably do that. Well, you may have to stretch it beyond that. It depends on how you choose to approach the supplemental material. Tales of the Black Freighter,
right.
Hollis Mason's autobiography Under the Hood.
In the case of the supplemental material, you have to include it, because any version of Watchmen, adapted version, that does not include the supplemental material, quite frankly,
is a piece of shit.
It's a piece of shit and doesn't deserve to exist.
That's right. And again, if you were to be involved in a project like that, you would be an objectively bad person.
I mean, really, no doubt about it.
Really should feel shame and should be wiped from all existence and history. Nevertheless, let's get off of this Watchmen topic, because it is divisive and it is unique. You know, we'll see what comes of it. And maybe it'll be great. You know, maybe I'll live to eat my words. Or maybe I'll eat that contract and leave enough room for your fist so you can ram it into my stomach and break my, you know, spine.
As much as we're sitting here questioning the need for it or the purpose of it or how it will work, there is no doubt that if it happens, we will
watch it. Oh, we'll watch the hell out of it. Absolutely.
Yeah,
like, and ultimately, what is the need for anything, really?
Yeah, I agree. But, I mean, it's just you have to question the need for this in particular when the guy who's going to do it is saying that the best version of it has already been done. You know what I mean? Like, it's not even like he's preaching a different take. He's pretty much like, yeah, I just want to do that. And I'm like, well, we've done that already. So,
not to mention that with an insular work like Watchmen, I don't know that I want to see another take. It's like, it's not, again, we make a lot of, as literary fans, not just comic book fans, we make a lot of concessions for superhero comics that in terms of characterization, in terms of the flexibility we allow and takes on characters, but there's a difference when it's an insular standalone story. I'll give you an example. Preacher. I think both of us, the problems that we did have with the first season of the TV show were in where it diverged from the book in terms of its characterizations. And as another example, if I am to watch something that is an adaptation of a Stephen King novel, for instance, I don't know anything about The Dark Tower, but I'm going to use that as an example. If The Dark Tower comes out and the characters in The Dark Tower do not share any similarities with the characters in the book The Dark Tower, then one would have to question, why do The Dark Tower?
Yeah. At a certain point, you can't have characters be characters in name only. So,
right. So, yeah.
Anyway,
it's interesting. But let's move on, and let's stick with DC Comics, and let's move on to the printed page. We got a couple of Dark Knight-related stories here. And one of them is a tie-in to the Dark Knight's Metal event. And these are the metal tie-ins. There's going to be seven of these standalone, I guess they're standalone, Nick, books that are going to focus on different corrupted versions of Batman that are spawned from the Dark Multiverse. These titles will be Batman, The Red Death, number one, by Joshua Williamson and Carmine DiGiannamabuduco. Batman, The Murder Machine, number one, by Frank Thierry and Riccardo Federici.
Oh, my God.
Batman, The Dawnbreaker, number one, by Sam Humphries and Ethan Van Sciver. Batman, The Drowned, number one, by Dan Abnett and Philip Tan. Batman, The Merciless, number one, by Peter J. Tomasi and Francis Manapul. Wow. Batman, The Devastator, number one, by Creative Team Not Announced. Ooh. And, of course, November 15th, The Batman Who Laughs, Creative Team Not Announced. We're also going to be getting crossover stories with Teen Titans, Nightwing, oh boy, and Suicide Squad.
Whoa! I did not notice that Suicide Squad. Look at that creative team, by the way.
Rob Williams and Stepjohn Sajic.
It's going to make me want to buy an issue of Suicide Squad.
I know it, but I could do without the writer, though. But
yeah, I could too, but fuck. Anyway.
That Stepjohn Sajic is awesome. We haven't even talked about how amazing the art looks from the upcoming Aquaman story, but we'll talk about that.
I've got it. I got to read it. We'll talk about it on next week's show.
That's right. Now, I get hesitant anytime I see Nightwing tied into a Batman event, quite frankly. Of course, I'm not on the book anymore, so what do I care? What do you make of this, Nick? These are some pretty powerhouse creative teams, and also that Flash artist, Carmen DiGiandomenico.
Yeah, I don't love the idea of doing $28 worth of event titles.
No.
I am hopeful that they will just be that, you know, ancillary stories that are not necessary to understand the larger metal storyline. But I will say that some of these have me intrigued based on the creative teams. I mean, you look at Dawnbreaker, which is apparently going to be a Green Lantern-themed take on an evil Batman by Humphries and Van Sciver. Drowned, which has got Abnett and Tan, and Merciless with Tomasi and Manapul. I think those three in particular are powerhouse creative teams that will certainly probably get me to pick up the books.
What do you think the Merciless gimmick will be?
Judging by the cover, it looks like it's a Wonder Woman story where it's almost like a cross pollination between Batman and Ares, judging by the silhouette of the character on the front. So
interesting.
Don't know what that's all about. Don't know what any of these are all about, really, because as much as I enjoyed Dark Days of the Forge, it really doesn't do much in terms of laying out what the story of metal actually is yet. So hard to really say with much faith what any of these are going to be about.
Yeah, the creative teams for some of these are really impressive. Humphries and Van Sciver and Tomasi and Manapul being my two most anticipated for these.
Hey, that Devastator cover kind of looks like a Batman version of Doomsday, does it not?
Yes, it does. It actually does, and it very well could be. I'm curious.
What's the logo? I don't recognize the logo.
God, I don't know.
I know it's got the bat wings on it, but what's that logo with the thing?
Hell if I know. It could be something New Gods related, but that definitely looks like Doomsday, though, which could be quite interesting. So, I mean, I'm glad that, you know, for people that want these, cool. And you know, these creative teams are amazing. But, man, I evil Batman seven times over. Like, it feels like it'll get a little repetitive.
Yeah, which is why I'm not interested in picking up all of them. But the ones with the great creative teams, you know, see what they bring to it, perhaps.
Right, right. Yeah, so there's some really great creative teams here. That's awesome. I just hope that this is not a sign of things to come from DC events, because this feels like overkill to me.
Well, to be fair, we know that the next big event following Metal, has, you know, Jeff Johns has already said, no tie-ins, no crossovers, just an event book. So.
Good, good. Well, let's move on from there, and let's stay with Batman, because we found out a pretty – what I thought was a pretty shocking announcement, Nick. Maybe you saw it coming, but – All-Star Batman is coming to an end with number 14. Scott Snyder announced that the series he's been working on since the beginning of Rebirth will end at number 14. However, he will continue the artistic collaborations that have been planned in what he calls a, quote, new format for DC Comics. He says on Twitter, quote, from the start, the All-Star Batman series was all about getting to collaborate with artists, giving them creative freedom so I'd be challenged to write differently, try new things with Batman. It's been one of the great joys and experiences of my career, and the new format will let All-Star Batman evolve. End quote. Snyder then tweeted that his first such project will be with Sean Gordon Murphy, who worked with Snyder, of course, on The Wake, and he said it would be solicited very soon. As for the new...
Oh, by the way, Sean Gordon Murphy has been tweeting out some teaser images from this book that he's working on. The art looks amazing, Greg. It looks absolutely outstanding.
Looking forward to it. As for the nature of the new format, Snyder told Comic Book Resources that it is a prestige format and said it's part of a new initiative DC is launching. So it doesn't sound like it's a new format per se. It's just taking advantage of what's been there the whole time. He said it. He didn't say that it would be similar to OGN's, and said that he couldn't get specific until DC formally announces it.
Yeah, I would imagine it's going to be some sort of hybrid between the prestige format and the OGN. Maybe a little bit longer, typically, than your average prestige format book, but a little bit shorter than your average OGN. Something that's a little bit more easily digestible and has a lower price tag that people can pick up at the comic shop off the shelf. Like, I'm envisioning something that's probably got, you know, that $10 or below price tag, but has enough meat there that you feel justified plopping down the money on it. I am interested to see what that format actually is, though, if it really is something new that DC is trying. I've long thought they don't really take advantage of the prestige opportunities that are there. I think it's a cool idea. And one that they've kind of abandoned over the last 10 to 15 years. But
yep.
In terms of All-Star Batman ending as a monthly, that was a little surprising, but pretty much sounds like he's just taking all of his plans for that title and transitioning him into the new format. So really, the series is only technically ending. And this will help my monthly pull. But I
oh, absolutely.
To have a book on it.
And he, from what he said in interviews, it seems like he this will allow him not to be as restricted by the pressures of monthly deadlines.
And page count and all that.
I wonder, Nick, if this might not be a format where it's going to have a variable page count based on the story.
Yep. Which would be the best thing for everybody involved, I think.
Sure.
Makes a lot of sense.
You might have one that's close to OGN length. You mm-hmm. might have one that's closer to just a traditional prestige length. And it could be something new and fresh. And
what's great about potentially doing it you know, on the newsstand as opposed to going straight to your – not the newsstand, excuse me. On the direct market stands as opposed to going straight to the OGN shelf – is you could potentially subsidize the cost of the book with ads rather than having it be ad-free, which typically winds up driving up the cost of the book, you know, to the $15 or above mark that we often see DC graphic novels launch with.
Particularly Hostess ads. You could just litter those throughout it if you wanted to. But I've long said this, Nick. I think that – I'm not going to say that it is the future because I don't know if they'll ever fully embrace it, but I believe that the way that people prefer to consume their media, including comics, has changed. And I think that people prefer this more to get more bang for their buck, so to speak. And so I have been advocating the OGN format for a long time, and I think the prestige format coming back could be a nice way as well to address this. Because the sheer volume that gets pushed out on a monthly basis in particularly superhero comics is so overwhelming. It is – and not just financially. It is financially overwhelming. But it's also just sensory overwhelming. I mean, my God, man, that Batman story – you're talking about seven individual books in addition to two standalone specials, in addition to an entire miniseries, in addition to all the regular ongoings. It's a lot of content. And so I feel like if this format can be successful, maybe this could be the start of something that sees a true revolution in the way that comics are presented. Yeah, because we talk all the time, Nick, about how comics tend to be written for the trade now anyway. Maybe this is the wave of the future. Who knows?
Quite frankly, it's not for us to say.
It's not. It's not for us to say. If you want to find out the real answers, tweet at JRsBBQ. Moving on to the next one. We also got another major comic book announcement this week from DC. We finally found out what the next Wonder Woman creative team will be. There's a fill-in team that's going to come in for about five or six issues here, filling in for Greg Rucka. And then as we head down the stretch in 2017, James Robinson is returning to DC Comics alongside artists Carlos Pagulian and Emanuela Lupacino.
Oh, my boy.
And they are taking over Wonder Woman with September 27th, number 31. And just as important as James Robinson making his return to the company is the fact that this is going to directly pick up a loose thread from the end of the New 52, which is the fact that at the end of the Darkseid War storyline, Geoff Johns revealed that Wonder Woman has a long-lost brother who was born on Themyscira and has been hidden from her. And this is going to pick that up and introduce us to this character of the mysterious Jason, the only male ever born on Themyscira, and a cosmic threat that they never imagined. So James Robinson, known, of course, for his amazing work on Starman back in the 90s, also JLA and countless other books, is back in the fold, and we're finally going to find out who this Jason is and what his tie truly is to Diana. Your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely excited. Not so much excited because it pretty much, you know, guarantees now that I'm going to keep Wonder Woman on my pull list.
Right.
For the duration.
Yeah. I was concerned about that as well.
You know,
well,
I was going to try out that that five-issue run coming from the DC Superhero Girls people, or at least Shea Fontana, who's worked on that. I don't know about Andolfo, if he's been involved with it or not. But in the event, now I'll just keep the book for the duration and carry it out through this. You know, I'm pumped about the story, don't get me wrong, but I do think, you know, once the story wraps up, they really need to find a team that's going to have a long-term vision for the character, because I don't think, you know, constantly swapping creative teams is what's best for the book. I think you need to find that next person who has big plans, because, you know, every time there's a creative team shift, you run the risk of losing,
yep,
of losing a portion of your readership, and I think you want to bring some stability back to it. So while I'm pumped, I hope this is the last of the little, you know, one story and out creative teams.
What's that line I've seen bandied about? Every jumping on point is also a jumping off point.
There you go.
And that you're right, that does carry that possibility. So maybe, though, Nick, I thought about this possibility. Is it possible that the reason these are two temporary teams is that the plan is for Greg Rucka to return next year?
Oh, that would be amazing. That would certainly be amazing. I don't think that is the plan, unfortunately, based on some information that I've read or heard, I should say. But it would be awesome if it was.
Let's hope. With that being said, that brings an end to the rundown, ladies and gentlemen. We are glad that you've stuck with us to this point. We were kind of all over the place there throughout this episode. To be honest, both of us are exhausted. Nick is sick. I'm just tired.
I'm not sick so much as I'm just in fucking pain. You know, there's a subtle difference there.
Well, you can be rage and I can be chaos, and together we'll be high voltage, Nick.
Well, quite frankly, I have nothing more to add.
Yeah, folks, so as I mentioned earlier, please get in contact with us. And holy crap, I want to apologize, ladies and gentlemen. I almost forgot. I was just reminded of this by seeing something just now. Last week on our review of the unaired pilot episode of NBC's Wonder Woman back in 2011, we were talking about this gentleman at the beginning of the episode that that Wonder Woman chases down and lassos, and he's a bald individual and skinny and looks kind of, you know, gangly. And we both thought that maybe he resembled Zazz from the TV show Gotham. Well, Nick, I've discovered that we were wrong about that. This individual was not Zazz from Gotham. This individual was actually NBA Commissioner David Silver.
Oh, Adam Silver, you mean?
Oh, damn it! David Silver's the guy from 90210. The character.
Well,
that,
I assumed you were combining David Stern and Adam Silver into one person, but
no, I knew the name Silver, but I was throwing in David Silver, the musician character from the great show Beverly Hills 90210.
The remarkable thing about Adam Silver is that he's got one of the smoothest bald heads you'll ever see. You could really stick that thing anywhere, much like Baron von Raschke.
Much like Baron von Raschke, discipline. So nevertheless, that brings it into the show, and we only have one more week left of Wonder Woman Month, but how are we going to wrap up this month, Nick?
Yeah, technically Wonder Woman Month actually comes to an end with this episode, because
or
this
does
is
it?
A yeah, – well, you know, however you want to look at it. June is a month that has five Thursdays, and as you know, on those months, we like to bring to you a little bonus content as we go giant-sized for our fifth Thursdays. And so next week, we bring to you the most prestigious night in all of Place to Be Nation. That's right. It's the 2017 Happy Awards. Once again, I will throw out the disclaimer that when you listen to this next week, please keep in mind we recorded this episode, the show, before the film Wonder Woman was released. So if you don't hear massive praise for Wonder Woman during the film portion of the award show, it is because we didn't see it. that's pretty much how it went down.
Yep.
On that one. But coming up after that, once we get you through the happies, we're going to be bringing to you, after a two-month hiatus, we're coming back to Hard Travelers for Hire, and we're kicking off Phase 2 of the Marvel Cinematic Universe with what is undoubtedly going to be the most contentious episode of Hard Travelers for Hire that we will likely ever record. Again, both Greg and I are of the opinion that there has not been a bad Marvel Cinematic Universe movie. However, there is no movie that we disagree more on, probably, than Iron Man 3. And so we're going
to... At least, perhaps, until we get to Doctor Strange.
Here's the thing. Doctor Strange and Ant-Man, we both disagree on, but I don't think we disagree nearly as passionately as we do about... Like, our gaps, the gaps in our enjoyment on Doctor Strange and Ant-Man are much smaller than the gaps of our enjoyment on Iron Man 3.
Probably so, yes. Yes, I would say that's probably true. Yeah.
And during that show, you'll hear Greg try to paint me into a corner as an endorser of racist characters from the 60s. He'll make all kinds of false arguments and
because you are
misrepresentations, and he'll try to make you think, folks, that I am something I am not.
He's going to be advocating for Chief J. Strongbow.
That is the
he's
lying
gonna be advocating
son of a bitch
for the
that
devious
is.
Mr. Fuji. He's going to be talking about Charlie Chan movies. He's going to be talking about You Only Live Twice, or whichever Bond movie it was where Sean Connery went in Asian face. He's going to be advocating all these things.
You see, once again, as you all know, Greg is full of shit. And that will continue into our Iron Man 3 episode. So get excited about that.
You know who's not full of shit very often, Nick?
Oh no.
Take a guess as to who might not be full of shit anymore, because he's often dropping it, and he's often seeing it dropped. Yeah. And that's Klondike Bill.
Klondike Bill. Oh, good old Klondike Bill. And then the rest of the month of July, we have some other things that are... What?
He was a lover.
He was a lover. The rest of the month of July, we have things planned that we haven't talked about in a while, so I don't know that they're actually going to happen. But we'll talk about them anyway right here. Apparently in July, judging by our master plan, we're going to review the Longbow Hunters for the Longbook Hunters.
the best laid plans.
That is subject to change, folks. And also, allegedly, we're going to be going off the page on the DC Comics deck building game. A game that we have threatened to review many times on the show and never actually done. So,
wonder who it was that forgot to bring the game the last time we were gathered together. Hmm.
Well, quite frankly, it's almost as if there's another group gathering planned.
Oh.
Before that episode would air, you some bitch.
Oh.
But in any event, one other thing I want to announce is that, you know, I mentioned to you that on the months where we have five Thursdays, we bring to you some bonus content. Next week, of course, is the Halfies. We have another giant size edition coming up in August. On the Iron Man 3 episode, that is the episode that will air be posted to the feed the first week of July. At the end of that episode, we will be not only officially announcing what our next giant size is, we're going to be hitting you with a trailer for that giant size. That's right, a trailer for a podcast. So, folks, if you want to hear one of the most unique situations that has ever occurred in the history of Place to Be Nation Pop, check out the end of our Iron Man 3 episode, and you will be utterly confused and bewildered by what you might find. That's pretty much all I want to say on that.
Yes, we reached out. We were not able to get Parv. We were not able to get voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly, but we were able to get some other prominent voices to show up.
That's true. That's true, including longtime Place to Be Nation Pop contributor, French actor Gerard Depardieu. So we got that going.
Gerard Depardieu. Very much looking forward to that. Well, with that being said, let us know how we're doing, folks. What do we need to do better? What do we need to review? What do we need to get rid of? What do you want us to talk about? You got any crazy unaired TV pilots you want us to watch? You got any movies you want us to watch? Any comics you want us to read? Let us know. Reach out to us. Again, on Twitter, at gphillips8652, at nickduke87, or preferably on our Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. With that being said, folks, be sure to tune in next week. Have a great weekend. Have a great week whenever you're listening to this. And go buy comics. Drink my wine. Come and dig my earth. None will level on the mine. Nobody of it is worth. But you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate. So let us stop talking falsely now. The hour's getting late. Hey!